I admit that I do watch The Biggest Loser. In fact, I enjoy watching The Biggest Loser, although I never thought I would. If you do not know what The Biggest Loser is, it's a reality TV series in which significantly overweight contestants compete in losing weight and getting fit by physical training and a change in diet, in order, of course, to win hundreds of thousands of dollars and the title of The Biggest Loser. I remember the first time I ever saw a billboard for the TV series The Biggest Loser. I thought, how insulting. Of course, I was totally misreading it. Anyway, a major part of the show is, of course, watching each of the contestants regain, or in some cases gain, their health and their self-confidence and a sustainable lifestyle. And I'm sure a big part of the reason why I've been drawn into watching this show is because you get to know the contestants and you watch them progress through incredible transformations. You share the experiences, of course, of their highs and lows, of their binges and their weight loss, of their tears and of their ecstasy. And what's always particularly interests me at the start of each season of The Biggest Loser is observing the level of commitment of each of the contestants. Of course, all of the contestants want to lose weight, but there are always a few who are not totally committed. They want to be healthy, but they don't want to make a complete change to their lifestyle in order to attain that. And so inevitably, some of those partially committed contestants go home very soon because their hearts simply are not in it. Those are the contestants I confess I feel most frustrated about, because I just think, what a waste. This is a golden opportunity. Anyway, thankfully, there are always some of those partially committed contestants who do find the motivation that they need to cross over, as it were, to make that wholehearted commitment. And what's also interesting to see is usually during the course of the season, they are the contestants who tend to make the biggest change, to experience the greatest transformation. They tend to often have the most dramatic stories, don't they? Well, the fact of the matter is that unless the contestants are sold out to achieving a healthy lifestyle, they will never make much progress, will they? Time and time again, they prove that. And whether they intend to do it or not, they prove it. Without single-minded commitment, you cannot accomplish a total lifestyle transformation. It has to be wholehearted. It has to be from the core of you. Well, in the Christian life, we are faced with a similar choice, but we are, of course, called to an even greater single-minded commitment, because our commitment is not just to this life, but it's for eternal life. And the truth that we're all faced with in Jesus' words this morning is that you cannot serve both God and money. You cannot serve both God and money. In verses 22 to 23, we read, "The eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness?" This word picture that Jesus paints is quite simple on the one hand, but on the other hand, it's also pretty confusing. I must confess that in my reading and preparing for this message, I was initially totally befuddled or confused by what Jesus exactly was getting at. What does he mean by "the eye is the lamp of the body"? How can an eye radiate light? Does Jesus have an antiquated or primitive understanding of biology or of ophthalmology? Well, of course, he's not giving a biology lesson. He's not lecturing in ophthalmology. In fact, Jesus is not even talking literally. Jesus is talking figuratively. He is using imagery, interestingly enough, that was very familiar to the people that he was talking to. So Jesus pictures a person's whole body as a room. A room, obviously, with no doors, no windows. Don't ask how the oxygen gets in. It's an image. It's not meant to be scientifically exact. The purpose of the eye is to illuminate the room, the body, to fill the room with light. The eye is, therefore, the source of light in the room, like a lamp. Now, if a person is going to be full of light, then, according to Jesus, his or her eye must be good. If the flame of the lamp is full, if it's steady and large, then, of course, the room, the person, will be entirely lit. But if the flame is smoky, if the wick is untrimmed, or if the fuel is depleted, then the room remains in darkness. The person is full of darkness. Well, that explains something of the imagery, but what does Jesus mean by a person's eye being good? Well, the word good in the original language actually was used in the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures, to translate the idea of singleness of purpose. Singleness of purpose, or undivided loyalty. So, the King James Version translates the word as single. In the King James Version we read, "If therefore thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be full of light." That's actually a great translation. So, what Jesus means by the single eye, therefore, is unswerving loyalty. Unswerving loyalty to God. He's talking about singleness of purpose, which is wholehearted faithfulness to God. The single eye is fixed on God. The single eye has an unwavering gaze upon God. The single eye is constantly, constantly focusing upon God. If you have a single eye, your whole body, your whole person will be full of light. Now, what light is that? Well, if we were to understand the context correctly, the context in which Jesus was talking, then light usually refers to revelation, and it also refers to purity. So the light that Jesus is talking about, that is shining inside the person, is knowing God and being godly. Jesus is saying, if all of your being, if all of your life, all of who you are is focused on God, you will have maximum understanding of God's revealed truth, and you will have pure behavior. If you have an undivided loyalty to God, you will know God deeply, and you will live a godly life. Well, I don't know about you, but I'm not sure that that's a very exact description of me, unfortunately. How many of us can describe ourselves in that undivided way? I'm not talking, of course, about cultural humility that forbids us from publicly blowing our own trumpet. I'm talking about private self-evaluation. How many of us can truly describe ourselves as enjoying maximum understanding of God's revealed truth and engaging in pure behavior? The eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? It's important to remember that the context in which Jesus gave this teaching about having a single eye is actually talking about money and possessions. Jesus has just called his listeners to stop storing up treasures on earth, which are destroyed by decay and are lost to thieves. And instead, Jesus urges his listeners to store up treasures in heaven, where things cannot be destroyed, where they cannot be stolen, where we can enjoy the treasure of God himself. The important thing, of course, is that you can't have both. You cannot store up treasures on earth and treasures in heaven. It's either treasures on earth or treasures in heaven. It's sort of like trying to watch your favorite TV program and simultaneously have a deep and meaningful conversation with a member of your family. It's not going to work. Guys try it often enough, of course, but only to their own detriment. It just doesn't work, does it? It's one or the other. Well, how many of us can describe ourselves as single-eyed? How many of us can affirm that we do have a profound knowledge of God and a robust godliness? How many of us can affirm that we have an undivided loyalty to God? Not many of us are full of light, are we? In fact, I would think many of our lamps are weak, they're dull, and the flame is barely flickering. Christians, we have to take Jesus' words seriously. We must choose between a relationship with our possessions and a relationship with God. We must live for God, not for money, which can let us down. Our bank statement should, in fact, shout out in emboldened font, in underlined font, in whatever, italicized font, that our treasure is clearly not here on earth. Our treasure is in heaven. Well, what is the alternative then if one is not full of light? Jesus tells us the alternative is being full of darkness. And that means you have no knowledge of God and you have no purity in your life. That means that you're without revelation and that you are ungodly. That's, of course, the life of a person who rejects Jesus. But surprisingly, Jesus tells us that there is a darkness even greater than that. There is a darkness even greater than being full of darkness. What could that possibly be? That deepest darkness is thinking that you are full of light, when in fact you are full of darkness. Jesus tells us that that is an even greater darkness. Of course, most churchgoers would not describe themselves as being filled with darkness, would they? Most people who call themselves Christians and frequently attend church would sincerely regard themselves as full of light. But what if they're sincerely wrong? What if they've deceived themselves? What if they've convinced themselves they're full of light when in fact they're full of darkness? That's a pitiful state, isn't it? Nothing could be more tragic than that. Nothing could be worse. Serving on vestry or as a church warden does not mean that you are full of light. Being ordained a deacon or a presbyter in the Anglican Church does not mean you are full of light. Serving in church ministry or playing in the band does not mean you are full of light. Friends, Jesus is calling us to earnestly and honestly examine ourselves. Owning a baptismal certificate does not mean you are full of light. Having been confirmed by the bishop does not mean you're full of light. Regularly sharing in the Lord's Supper does not mean that you are full of light. Jesus is urging us to check and to double check our spiritual well-being. We do that in other parts of our life, don't we? If after turning the appliance off, you go back to the stove, or you go back to the heater, or you go back to the barbecue to make sure that it is turned off, that you're not wasting electricity or wasting gas, or worse yet, inadvertently starting a fire. Well, if you're willing to go back and check those sorts of things, shouldn't you show the same caution with your spiritual well-being? If a skydiver is willing to check and recheck and triple check that his gear is in perfect working order in order to make sure that he doesn't lose his life, well, how much more should you and I be concerned for our spiritual well-being? Jesus tells us we must be single-eyed if we are to know and live for God. You cannot serve both God and money. And in verse 24, Jesus continues, "No one can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money." Now, there are three things that we need to understand in Jesus' words in verse 24 if we're to make full sense of them. The first is that we need to understand what Jesus means by the word master. Jesus is not talking about an equivalent today in our contemporary culture. He's not talking about an employer. Jesus is not saying that you cannot work for two employers simultaneously and give them your best. We know that's possible, don't we? We know it's possible to hold down two jobs at the same time and to give all your energy to them as best you can. Jesus is not talking about employers. And he's also not talking about submitting to different authorities. So you submit to the federal government at the same time that you submit to the state government. That's easy enough. Or submitting to the rules of the road whilst you're also submitting to the instructions of your employer. We can do that. That's not what Jesus is talking about. Jesus is using the language of slavery. It is difficult for us to understand the terminology of master, even though we think we know what it's all about, because the reality is that slavery, rightly, is illegal in Australia, and so we're not at all familiar with it. We know very little about it. Slavery, by its very nature, is entirely exclusive. One commentator has written, "Single ownership and full-time service are of the essence of slavery." Single ownership and full-time service are of the essence of slavery. In other words, in slavery, it is impossible to belong to two masters. There's no use in trying to serve two masters in slavery. Well, that's the first thing we need to understand. We need to understand what Jesus means by master. Secondly, we also need to understand Jesus' use of the emotions of hate and love. Jesus' words, frankly, sound unrealistic, don't they? They sound quite ridiculous. But the reason they do is because we're not culturally familiar with the idiom that he is using. He is using a Semitic idiom, which we in English simply do not use. And so Don Carson has helpfully explained Jesus' words in this way. "To hate one of two alternatives and to love the other simply means the latter is strongly preferred, especially if there is any contest between the two." I'll read that again. "To hate one of two alternatives and to love the other simply means that the latter is strongly preferred, especially if there is a contrast between the two." So Jesus uses this idiom more than once. For example, in Luke chapter 14, Jesus states, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, he cannot be my disciple." Yet we also know that in Mark chapter 7, Jesus insists that people honor their parents with integrity. Jesus is clearly not telling us to hate our parents in Luke chapter 14. He's telling us rather to love and honor Jesus above our parents. To love and honor Jesus so much so that it almost is as if we hate our parents. Jesus is not calling us here in this passage to hate money as much as he is calling us to love God more than anything. Well, those are the first two things we need to understand. Firstly, what Jesus means by master. Secondly, what he means by hate and love. And thirdly, we need to understand what Jesus is referring to when we read the word money. We assume we know exactly what he's talking about, but our translation actually obscures what Jesus is really saying. The word in the original Greek is not money. The word in the original Greek is mammona, and that is transliterated in some Greek translations as mammon, which perhaps those who have read the King James Version would be especially familiar with. The word mammon is not an English word. It's not even a Greek word. It actually comes from Aramaic, the language that Jesus most likely spoke on a day-to-day basis. And the word mammon originally meant something in which one puts one's confidence. That's a bit different to money, isn't it? Mammon originally meant something in which one puts one's confidence. Now, eventually, probably because human confidence is so often placed in riches, mammon came to refer to material possessions. It came to refer to profit, to wealth, to money. Either we place our confidence in God, or we place our confidence in money. Jesus said, "No one can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money." Jesus is warning us that we cannot divide ourselves between God and wealth and property. It's impossible to divide our loyalties between God and money. There's no such thing as partial discipleship. We can't just follow Jesus in part. It doesn't work. But that's exactly what we try to do, isn't it? Of course, we'd never, ever say so. But that is exactly what we try to do. And our lives betray us. We strive to compromise in our service to God so that we can also serve money. So when it comes to building a house or buying a house, we seldom, if ever, give any thought to ensuring that we are located close to a good church. Why would that be important? Instead, we're much more concerned about getting the most bang for our buck, and we're most concerned about proximity to work or proximity to school, or even comfort in our retirement. Funny how the church doesn't really figure much in that. Or if we find ourselves in the position of choosing between remaining in our present job or taking another job, our primary motivation for choosing one job over the other is highly unlikely to be the opportunity that each presents us to serve the Lord. Or even which job will give us more time to disciple our family. No, instead, we are primarily motivated by what? The size of the salary. Or if we decide to replace a vehicle, it is seldom that we give any consideration to whether buying a new car would be a responsible stewardship of God's gifts, or how we might use that vehicle in ministry to others beyond our immediate family. Instead, what do? We give a great deal of consideration to keeping up with our neighbors, or better yet, beating them. The truth is, whether we're talking about substantial purchases or simply everyday spending, as middle-class Christians living in a consumeristic culture like we do, we are constantly, constantly tempted to devote ourselves to our wealth, to our possessions, and not to God. But it's also important to recognize that this isn't just true of our spending. That would get half of us off the hook, wouldn't it? It's not just our spending which reveals our divided loyalties. It's also our investing which reveals our divided loyalties. We show that we are trying to serve two masters when we put our trust in our super to give us security in the future. And we do that, don't we? We show that we are trying to serve two masters when we rely on our investments to provide for our well-being, not God. We show that we are trying to serve two masters when we put our faith in our stocks or in our savings to protect us from any harm. That's our safety net. Not God. Our attempts to serve God and money do not only betray a half-hearted commitment to discipleship, but they expose something much worse. Our attempts to serve both God and money expose our idolatry. What are we worshipping? We are either worshipping mammon, which of course cares nothing for us, or we are worshipping God, who loves us deeply. If we give our lives to obtaining more and more possessions, the next best thing, we will simultaneously be turning our backs on God. Either God is served with single-eyed devotion, or God is not served at all. You cannot serve both God and money. Let's pray.